And welcome back to the second half of The Source on KSTXM, David Martin Davies. What does poverty today look like? We're all familiar with the Depression-era photos, black and white, grainy, grim-faced, and determined, but hopelessness not, you know, there. And earlier than that, in the 1890s, photographs of Jacob Rice in the New York slums, his work on how the other half lives. Echoes of that today in the book, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Author Sasha Abramski joins us this half hour to talk about the prevalence of poverty in America and how it could possibly be fixed with some policy changes in Washington, D.C. Welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having me on.
So you traveled the United States talking to people who were in the grips of poverty. Tell me about your travels.
Yeah, I basically was working on this book for several years, and I went to about 15 to 20 states, and it seemed to me that this was important because a lot of times journalists tend to stay in one city. So if they're New York-based, they stay in New York. If they're L.A.-based, they do most of their reporting in L.A. and so on. And it seemed to me that really, this was a national story, and that if you were going to understand poverty in America, you were going to understand what the impact was of unemployment or of housing foreclosures or of entire communities where pensions had bellied up, that it was imperative that I really get out there and report on the ground in those communities. And so I drove and I flew and I took trains and I basically traveled by every way I could. And I went around the country talking to people and recording the interviews and putting the interviews into an audio archive. And then over a course of several years, putting it together as a book. So that's basically how I traveled covering this story.
And what were people telling you? Who did you meet? What did you find?
Well, I think the first thing that struck me was that you can't reduce poverty to stereotypes. And that might sound simple, but too often when we cover poverty, we do reduce it to stereotypes. We reduce it to people who are mentally ill or to drug addicts or to people who've done something bizarre or counterproductive that plunges them into poverty. What you find when you report this is that it's everybody. It's people who thought they were middle class until a recession hit and they lost their jobs or their house went underwater. It's people who were doing okay and then they had a medical emergency and the medicines were so expensive that it just plunged them either into instability or even worse, into bankruptcy. It's children who are living out of cars when they're going to school. It's veterans who are coming home and are living in motels with their family. It's people who thought that they were going to be able to retire 5 or 10 years from now, and then they lost their job. And they might have a new job now, but instead of it paying $60,000 a year, it's paying $15,000 or $20,000 a year. So I think what you see, or what I saw when I went around the country, is that poverty is, A, as complicated as is America itself, and B, it doesn't always manifest itself the way we expect it to. You can go into a McMansion in a suburb of Las Vegas or a suburb of Stockton in California. And the person's living in a 3,000-square-foot home, and on the surface they're doing just fine, except every single bill is unpaid. Their children aren't eating, or if they are eating, they're eating free school lunches, free school breakfasts, and food stamps, or the food from food stamps. And I think the more I explored this, the more I was humbled by what I was finding, that this really was just such a complicated story, and the lives that were being entrapped in this new form of poverty were just so difficult, and so many people were being trapped in this poverty. This wasn't something that was affecting 5 people here or 10 people there. It was affecting hundreds of thousands and then millions, and finally, if you look at the poverty data, over the last few years, tens of millions of Americans, 1 in 6, 1 in 7 Americans are now hungry. That's extraordinary. We're the wealthiest country in the world, and 47 million people are poor enough to qualify for food stamps. And so I think the more I explored this, the more I realized that this, in a sense, is the story of our era, and that it's at least as important as any other American story in the 21st century.
You said this is a new form of poverty. What is the new form?
But we've always had poverty. America's always been a country of extremes. So we've always had, amidst the affluence, we've had slums, and amidst the affluence, we've had trailer communities, and amidst the affluence, we've had people totally left out of the American dream, whether that's people on Native American reservations or whether it's African American communities deep in the Mississippi Delta. There have always been hotspots of poverty. And Michael Harrington, the great social activist from half a century ago, when he wrote The Other America, he looked at that, and he talked about a sort of poverty hidden in plain view amidst affluence. I think think the new form of poverty that we started to see about 30 years ago, but that accelerated during the Bush presidency and then was completely turbocharged by the Great Recession, new poverty, in a sense, is counterintuitive. It's unexpected. So as I said, it's people who look like they're doing okay, but everything's gone wrong. It's people who have higher education degrees in some cases, and they're drowning in student debt. People who spent decades building up nest eggs, and then those nest eggs were just absolutely disappeared by the financial crisis. People who lost everything, ran through their savings, did everything they possibly could to be able to stay in their own homes after their homes went underwater. And they still couldn't manage, and they ended up with literally nothing. So examples would be, I talked to a family in Des Moines, Iowa. The man was an electrician, and he must have been in his late 50s, had several health problems. And their house had gone underwater, and he'd lost his job. And there they were in their late 50s, this couple. They were basically starting from scratch. They'd lost all of their life savings. They'd lost all the security that goes with owning your own home. And I was talking to them in the offices of this organization that had introduced me, and there they are standing there with this look like they're deer caught in the headlights, that they did not know what was going to happen to them next. I had a very similar interview with a man called Matthew Joseph in Stockton. He was a sheet metal worker and a deacon in his local church. Same thing had happened. He'd been called into his boss's office one day at the beginning of the recession, and he'd been laid off. He spent months wrestling with his bank, trying to get his mortgage refinanced so that he and his wife wouldn't lose his home. And he talked to me about how he curled up in a fetal position on his bed, thinking, what am I going to do? How am I going to survive this moment? I think that's what I mean when I say it's unexpected, that you can go all around the country and you encounter these stories, that this is one of the new American realities. And what's one of the things that's most striking to me is we've built our self-image as a country on the idea of opportunity, the idea of upward mobility. It's absolutely central to the American story. You look at the data from the last few decades, and especially the last decade, that social mobility has disappeared. We think we're a socially mobile country, but when you actually crunch the numbers, we're less socially mobile than almost every other social democracy. What that means is if you're born poor, you're more likely to stay poor. And if you fall into poverty, you're less likely to emerge from poverty. It's a sort of countervailing story to the American dream. I don't think it's been explored enough. And one of the things as a journalist I always want to do is to explore the unexplored. And to me, as I said, this is just one of the absolutely fascinating stories of our moment.
As you speak to these people, are they angry? And if they are angry, are they angry at the right people?
Now, that's a great question, because one of the things that surprised me was that while some people are angry, some people are very, very angry, there's also both a tremendous amount of resilience. And I was absolutely overawed when I'd meet people and they had everything running against them, and they were still pushing to make their lives better, and in particular to make their children's lives better. They were doing everything they could, whether it was working three jobs, whether it was going back to school and accumulating tremendous debt. They were doing everything they could to try to better their condition and their children's condition. Now, again, you know, oftentimes...
Sasha, I got to take a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. I want to talk about some policy changes that you mentioned in your book, and also about what poverty does to the brain. We're talking to Sasha Abramski. He's the author of The American Way of Poverty. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book, The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. The author is Sasha Abramski. He traveled the country talking to people who are under the heel of poverty. And so, Sasha, let me ask you, do you think that the United States, that we have an attitude problem about poverty? We don't want to talk about it. It didn't come up in the last presidential election. You never saw it as an issue being bandied back and forth in debates between President Obama and Mitt Romney. Why aren't we talking about these things?
That is one of the great questions, because so many people are in poverty. And as you said, the political leadership is incredibly reluctant to take it on, and in part that's because there's very little political capital to be gained from taking it on. Fewer poor people vote, fewer poor people know their rights, fewer poor people take part in the political processes. And so for various reasons, both Democrats and Republicans tend to shy away from explicitly talking about poverty. They talk about the middle classes a lot. They talk about preserving the living standards and the wages and the employment and so on of the middle classes. And in some ways, that substitutes for poverty, because a lot of the issues that are being talked about are, in reality, issues that you could broaden the discussion about and talk about poor people as well as middle-class people. But linguistically, we truncate it. But I think there's a bigger problem, which is an empathy gap. And you see this especially on conservative talk radio and talk television. One of the things that astonished me, the more I researched this, I listened to a lot of Rush Limbaugh. And one of his broadcasts in particular struck me. He was talking about thousands of young children who were on a free school breakfast and school lunch program. I believe it was in St. Louis. And during the summers, there was a bridging program, because one of the things that happens in poor neighborhoods is that a lot of poor children go hungry in the summer months when they can't access free food at school. And so a lot of areas have begun experimenting with what they call summer feeding programs, and it's a way that poor families can have their children fed during the summer months. Rush Limbaugh, and on a tirade about how this was creating, and this is a quote, wanton little waifs and serfs. And I looked at this and I did a double take, and I read it online. I looked at it and I thought, surely I'm mishearing that, I'm misreading it. So I actually listened to the broadcast, and sure enough, he talks about wanton little waifs and serfs. And I've interviewed a lot of kids who go hungry and who rely on school meals to feed them, and these are kids who will tell you, when I go home in the evenings, if I'm lucky, I get dry cereal. When I wake up in the morning, I'm sent to school with nothing. I've talked to their teachers, and their teachers tell me about how difficult it is to teach children who have no food in their stomach. These are growing kids, and they have no food in their stomach. And the idea that one of the most influential commentators in the country could use his platform to beat up on and to bully these children struck me as absolutely extraordinary. And I do think it speaks to an empathy gap. Now, if that was the only conversation going on in the country, I'd be deeply pessimistic. But I also think there are many other people who understand what poverty is and understand the corrosive impact it has on the lives of millions of Americans, and who are working very, very hard to remedy this, whether it's in policy, whether it's in school situations, whether it's as community organizers, and so on. There are people who care about this.
Okay, let me go to the phone lines, and our phone lines are open. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. Clayton is on the line. Clayton, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, and I would like your guest to comment on, do you think that the poor are used as political pawns, or is there any particular group that has a vested interest in there being a large group of people living in poverty? And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
All right, Clayton, thank you for that call. Appreciate it. So I think Clayton wants to see, are there people who benefit from having this poor underclass and keeping them dependent on the government, so that there are people who can be their leaders and be in a place of power?
Well, I think actually I turn the question around. I'm not sure that there are – I don't think there's a huge – political gain to be had from keeping people using welfare. But I do think that private companies have a huge amount at stake in keeping wages low and in pushing off benefits onto the state. So an example would be Walmart. And I interviewed a lot of Walmart workers, including some in Texas. In 2012, the average pay for a Walmart sales associate was $8.88 an hour. For someone that they term a guest service team member, it was $8.42. And for a cashier, it was $8.62. So that's about a dollar over minimum wage. And that's paid by the biggest company in the world. Now, the only way they get away with that is that a lot of their staff are so poor that they end up on state Medicaid systems, they end up accessing food stamps and other benefits. I do think that you see this repeatedly, that large corporations use the political process very effectively to stymie attempts to raise the minimum wage. They use it very effectively to stymie attempts to increase benefits, whether it's health benefits, whether it's pensions, to employees. And the end result is an awful lot of the working poor get pushed off and become people who need to rely on state assistance, food stamps being the most obvious case in point. And I think this speaks to a larger issue, which is that over the last 30 years, we've had a stampede towards inequality in this country. Not just a little bit of inequality, but a higher level of inequality than America's ever had, apart from during the Gilded Age at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. We have levels of inequality that even exceed the years preceding the Great Depression. Now, what that means is we've got some people who are doing fabulously well from this economy. We've got billionaires who control a tremendous proportion of the American gross national product. We also have a tremendous well of people at the bottom who are earning too little to survive on their income. We have millions more who are now so discouraged that they're either dropping out of the labor market or they're having to accept downward mobility as a fact of life. And then we have 14 million who are unemployed. So I don't think that it's that people are creating a sort of political client class who need government services and therefore respond to politicians who will promise them government services. I'd say quite the reverse, that we've created a pool of poverty which is largely, though not exclusively, tied in with the way our economy functions, especially our private sector economy.
All right, Sasha, let me get to another caller. I got that. So let me get to another caller. Brooke is on the line. Brooke, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thanks. I teach here. I teach kindergarten here in San Antonio for the Northeast ISD. And one thing that your guest said that really stood out to me was the word empathy. And I'm pretty tired of hearing people talk about how the poor people are using the system and, you know, I'm paying for this and that for them. I see their kids, and I see these people work 2-3 jobs and can't even make ends meet. And they don't want their children to be hungry. It's not as if they, you know, woke up one day and said, I really want to starve my kid. These people work hard at menial jobs, and they can't make ends meet working 2 or 3 jobs. And I get really frustrated because, like, my family and a lot of even friends here in our lovely state are very non-empathetic to people who are in situations that they just can't even comprehend. And, I just wish people could get that empathy. They just need to walk a mile in those shoes.
All right, Brooke.
Out of control.
Brooke, thank you for your call. Appreciate it. Thanks for being a teacher. So, Sasha, you talk about the social Darwinism and how people use that as a justifier for looking down on the poor.
Yeah, I think it's selective social Darwinism. And actually, what Brooke just said was really an interesting point, because there are certain areas of government aid that we think of as welfare, and the people who receive that aid we're particularly non-empathetic to. So someone, let's say, on temporary aid to needy families. In many states, those people will be fingerprinted first before they can access benefits. There have been proposals put out to increase the amount of fingerprinting done for food stamp access. There have been proposals to make you have to go through criminal background checks and fingerprinting before you get unemployment benefits. So I think for people at the bottom of the economy, there really is social Darwinism. But then let's look at other kinds of government assistance that we don't think of as welfare, but that actually cost the government far more. Two examples would be Social Security for the elderly and mortgage tax relief. Imagine the outcry in Texas and everywhere else in the country if the governor were to propose fingerprinting or doing a drug test for every single person before they could access mortgage tax relief. Or imagine the outrage if Rick Perry or any other politician were to say, well, before you get your Social Security check, we're going to make you pee into a cup just to make sure you're not taking illegal substances. So I think when we talk about social Darwinism or the lack of empathy, it's an incredibly selective lack of empathy. And part of the challenge in my book is I want to humanize the lives of the poor, and I want to create a set of policy solutions that don't just benefit certain groups. We have policy solutions at the moment, yes, like mortgage tax relief, that shore up the income of the middle classes.
So let's talk about those. You talk about that in a book. You have a blueprint there for social policies that can change, government policies that can have an impact on the way that wealth is flowing in America. Right now, wealth is flowing to the top from the bottom. Or can that be reversed?
Absolutely. It can be reversed through changes in the tax code. It can be reversed through changes in the way we fund higher education. It can be reversed legislatively to a degree through minimum wage and living wage laws. It can be reversed through very creative taxes on things like oil profits and then cycling that money back into the system. Alaska did that. They have an oil profit dividend where every single resident of Alaska gets a proportion of the oil profits. And that can result, depending on the year, but it can be thousands of dollars per resident. Now, there's no reason we can't do that in other states. We could have oil profit taxes. We could tax mineral resource extraction.
Right, but we are out of time. Sasha Abramski, the author of The American Way of Poverty, How the Other Half Still Lives. Thank you for joining us. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be back tomorrow.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.